on KBO 90.7 FM. And we'll be back on January 20th at 9 a.m. And there it is.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on Monday, December 19th at 6 p.m. This month's board meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found at our website at kboo.com.
Welcome to Heartland Stories Radio. Join us as host Teresa Marquez talks to experts on the future of food, farming, and public health. Heartland Stories, supporting children's health in the Heartland. Now, here's host Teresa Marquez.
Hello, and welcome to Heartland Stories Radio and Podcast. I am Teresa Marquez, and I am here today with Robert Gottlieb, Professor Emeritus of Urban and Environmental Policy, and really, really exciting to say this as well, founder and former director of the Urban Environmental Policy Institute of Occidental College. They call it UEPI. And Professor Gottlieb research is focused on environmental and food justice, care politics, power and inequality, global cities, and the infrastructure of everyday life. He is also the author of numerous publications, including 14 books. And I hope that we will be able to dive in a little bit to his newest book, Care-Centered Politics. I want to also say Professor Gottlieb is 60 years as a change agent in social environmental issues. So, wow, it is a tremendous honor, Professor Gottlieb, to be speaking with you today.
Well, it's great to be with you.
I'm from Portland, Oregon, so I was kind of excited to read that, you know, you went to Reed College, you did a year abroad, you were born and raised in Brooklyn, went back to Brooklyn, and this is where I have a curiosity, then decided to go to Los Angeles in 1969. what really attracted you to Los Angeles in 1969?
Well, it's interesting because I was very engaged in the student movement and then the anti-Vietnam War politics. I was part of an organization called the Students for a Democratic Society. And if you recall, in 1969, sort of at the height of social protests and the building of the opposition against the war, the powerful movements around racism. There was also a lot of turmoil within the social movements and different organizations. So I knew I needed a change from sort of the hothouse politics of New York. And Los Angeles was very appealing. LA is sort of representative at that time of, if you will, the conservative heartland on the coast, but also one that was really changing. And I was particularly interested in environmental politics. And I thought, what better place to be than in LA, which had such enormous range of environmental issues.
Indeed, and we're going to probably go into a couple more of those challenges as we go into this. Always challenges in there. But you started out teaching at UCLA, and it sounded to me like you were a bit of a troublemaker there.
Always a troublemaker, I guess. Yes, you know, it's interesting because I had really parachuted into the academic world. I had been continue to be politically active. I had been a journalist. I did a syndicated newspaper column, a number of things that were outside the university. But I entered into the university really wanting to make the link between community action and academic research. And a group I supervised in 1992 wanted to do a kind of an environmental justice research project on the sort of the where and how low-income communities were so vulnerable to some of those environmental problems. And the riots happened in 1992 as the students were organizing themselves to do research. They went into the community after the riots and said, we'd like to work with you to think about what research needs you have in terms of issues that are most critical for the community. And the response they got was food. Food was so critical. For whole kinds of reasons, the lack of access to healthy food, the exorbitant costs of food, even in comparison to wealthier areas, and the desire for alternative kinds of approaches to food. Whether community gardens or relation to access to healthy food. And the students, led by someone I think you've had on your show, Andy Fisher, produced a report called Seeds of Change that in turn identified the idea of a kind of community food politics as a way to bring a lot of these issues together. And it was also served as a kind of an epiphany for myself. You know, the environmental justice mantra of environment is where we live, where we work, where we play, was, of course, where we eat and how we eat and what we eat fit right into that kind of broader politics and broader discourse, the language of understanding what environment was all about is also understanding how food connects back to some of those same issues. You know, that study and a couple of others that I'd worked on with students showed that community politics was very important for academic research. And I used to be criticized by some people at the school saying, how is cutting up carrots having anything to do with research? And, you know, in the end, it was my shift over from UCLA to Occidental College and bringing our institute over from UCLA to Occidental really served to enable me to continue that work at a different scale and be very much connected back to community politics. So it was a wonderful journey for me to do it that way.
Well, you know, it's very, very clear that you really are very clearly looking all the time about what are the needs that we have for change, what's important. And I have a feeling that the Urban and Environmental Policy Institute, UEPI, was perhaps came out of that something that you saw that was a real need. I wondered if you could talk about what gave you the inspiration to birth UEPI.
Well, UEPI was very much the idea that you can't really divorce research from action and action from making change happen. And the work that really was started at UCLA on a whole range of issues, and also trying to link those issues and that research to where and how you can start making change happen. So one example of that was a program that we called and is well known now around the country and around the world, Farm to School, and a subset of that, Farm to Preschool, that we developed subsequently. And Farm to School really started out by understanding that in order to institutionalize this concept of getting access to direct from the farm food into the school cafeteria, or into people's homes, I should say, or places where people could access that food, would really be strengthened if it was institutional based, if you connected it to an institution like a school. So we decided to develop some pilot programs. We approached the school food director at the Santa Monica schools. We thought that would be an interesting, important venue to explore this idea of bringing food directly from the farm into the school cafeteria. And he was skeptical, so he allowed us to do a pilot for a week during the summer. And he said that he would see how popular what he called the farmer's market salad bar would be if the option was either choosing that or a pizza for the students. And this was an elementary school where we explored this possibility. Well, one of our staff members was an organizer, and she worked with the parents. It was a predominantly Latino school, a Latino-based school. And she found that the students loved a school garden that had just been created. They loved the harvesting. They loved tasting the food. So she did a taste test for the kids and got them to taste food that was actually going to be provided by the farmers who were going to stock the cafeteria for that first week. And the kids loved it. They say, hey, this is garden food. I love this food. You mean this is going to be in our cafeteria? And so lo and behold, about 75% of the students that week chose, in this pilot week program, chose the farmer's market salad bar, as it was called. Meanwhile, the school food director, a man by the name of Rodney Taylor, had his epiphany. He said, you know, I've been doing this work as on a business model. And really what I should be doing this is thinking about providing healthy food and being a health champion. And he became a wonderful advocate for this idea of farm to school. And he went on to do that not only in the Santa Monica schools and then Riverside County, but he went back east and did it one of the largest county school districts in the Maryland, Washington, D.C. area. And he was a voice to talk to other school food service directors to say, this should be our mission. And of course, now Farm to School, out of that, a network was created, now called the National Farm to School Network. It's, as you know, it's in all 50 states. Similar kinds of programs are in dozens and dozens of countries, both in the global south and in Europe and Canada. And it's a major success story. And another dimension of it that particularly Rodney was a champion for the idea that everybody in the school world could be a champion of this program. And that included the so-called quote-unquote lunch ladies, the people who served the meals, who were often low income, not paid very well, overworked, but when participating as health champions, as, if you will, food justice champions, they became really crucial to engaging with the kids and saying, look, taste this food. How wonderful it would be for you to have this type of approach. So that concept of kind of, in effect, a kind of cooperative community building process, engaging the people who work, the people who are the eaters, the consumers, if you will, the larger world of parents and teachers and staff and food service directors, was very much in line with, as I developed programs and then research that led to the Care Center Politics book. That's a model of a care program and a care institution and a care politics. When you have those kinds of connections and that kind of community building and that notion of both equity, because after all, many of the kids in particularly the public school system don't have access to healthy food in their communities, in their neighborhoods. So having healthy food that's universally available is a really critical equity issue that ties into a kind of a care politics ethic, if you will.
Well, if you're just joining us, I am Teresa Marquez, and I am here today with Robert Gottlieb on Heartland Stories Radio. And Robert Gottlieb is Professor Emeritus of Urban and Environmental Policy and founder of a wonderful Occidental program called the Urban Environmental Policy Institute. You know, the fact that you and your students birthed the whole Farm to School program, the fact that your student Andy Fisher founded the Community Food Security Coalition, and there's a long list of, I think, the kinds of things that you've inspired. Also, while you talked about the people in the lunch room, the women who are there helping put the lunches together and everything, it reminded me of a part of your new book, Care-Centered Politics, From the Home to the Planet, where you talk about the impact and the importance of the COVID-19 situation, where we actually identified essential workers for a change. And I wondered if you could say something about the impact of COVID that you talk about in the care-centered politics and how it, you know, is impacting change and the way that we're taking a look at social issues and environmental issues and how they're all related.
Yeah, COVID is has been and is still crucial for thinking about the kinds of system changes that are needed because of the impacts that COVID had on both the terms of the people who were most vulnerable to COVID, how resources were utilized, and as you said, the essential workforce, which was really fundamentally what we would call care work, who in turn were also some of the most vulnerable people at work because they were essential. They needed to be present. They couldn't work virtually, if you will. And this includes everything from farm workers, a number of people working in the health world, for people working in retail. Essential workers, as one care researcher put it, were not stockbrokers. They were people in the care economy. And it was important to understand that from the lessons of COVID, that this care workforce needed to be supported in fundamental ways that hadn't, and still in many ways hasn't, applied, whether it's in terms of the income, whether it's the issues of exposure and vulnerability and lack of really standard safety and health strategies for how the work is done. It's also what was important, that this is what I called in the book relational work. The care is about the relationships between those who provide the care, if you will, and the work they do, and those who receive the care. And care work is most fundamentally supportive when it's a relationship that it cares with rather than simply caring for, that there's a relationship, there's a connection between those who provide the care and those who receive the care. And that requires us to rethink about how work is structured, that COVID really provided some important lessons. The other thing to say about COVID that I talked about in the book and which has been so clear is how care institutions like schools are really important in relation to food, going back to this school food connection. When schools closed down because of COVID, you had a crisis of food access for, you know, millions and millions of children. So the schools became food providers even as they shut down. They continued to set up ways in which food could be accessed. I think that's another really critical, important way of thinking about these institutions that really are part of the care economy and are central to what we need to do to change the way the care economy has been so poorly supported.
You know, I have a tough question I'm trying to formulate that I've been trying to formulate in my own mind for quite a while now, and that is, here we are in a capitalistic system where the thing that's the power is profit at all costs, no matter what. And we have, you know, food and food justice, housing and housing justice, all of those things under that capitalistic all-for-profit. And I'm just wondering, can two different kinds of economic structures exist together? A capitalist structure that is only for profit, whereas we have all these other needs going on too. And how do we get those things together in a way that, can we reform capitalism? I don't think so, but are we on two different paths here, economic and the structure of things?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's so much within the way capitalism impacts daily life and infrastructure that really undermines the capacity of an institution or an economy to deal with care. I would call it a kind of an anti-care philosophy when you take over and you try and privatize things like libraries and post offices and schools, because that's happening also in terms of trying to sort of undermine the idea that schools are public institutions and institutions of care rather than institutions that are designed for the sort of the private market-based systems. So how do you change that? You know, it's incredibly challenging when there's such a dominant language and a dominant system focus on things like privatizing institutions and designing them within the structure of profit making, and those who are making the profits having the kind of power to influence daily life. So you need to absolutely develop alternatives to that, but you also need to develop alternatives in a way that expands the possibility of creating a care economy and care institutions that are not designed with the market in mind, but instead are dealing with people's human rights and having a care ethic associated with it. That's a challenge. There have been initiatives that sort of build on existing initiatives. Farm to school is a good example of, you know, one small aspect of how you change that relationship. But you also need to guard against the idea that this is somehow still within a kind of market framework. You don't want it in a market framework. You want it in a care framework. And you want food to be seen as a right, housing as a right, health as a right that people have. And a care politics and a care economy approach can move towards that. How do you make that shift? Well, it starts in part by building movements, doing community building, having cooperative institutions as well as cooperative relationships, changing the language so that value is associated with cooperation rather than acquisition. It's seeing that the idea of growth and consumerism can, in fact, and have contributed to inequality and the lack of those core and fundamental rights. So that really requires transforming institutions at the same time. You know, and here we are in an age of pandemics, a climate crisis, of heightened racial tensions, of great inequalities, and bringing about that kind of transformation will really require it happening at multiple levels. And not somehow isolating that idea of change from in one area that's really separate from some of these other areas.
You know, I am really certainly am so in wonderment of how, you know, we can create perhaps this more creative work in the cooperative movement. You know, one out of every three Americans are co-op members, et cetera. So it seems like, you know, this idea of socialism being the boogeyman for so many people, I see it's already here. And mm-hmm. I don't see how we can continue this capitalist structure without this other piece of cooperation.
You know, sometimes in the midst of sort of the deepest and most consequential challenges that one faces, there emerges the sense of possibility. And I think, you know, my book was being written during the year 2020, 2021. And boy, did we ever experience that, both the challenges and then the Black Lives Matter demonstration is the largest outpouring the world had experienced in terms of, you know, wanting to see the kinds of transformations that we needed to see happen. it wasn't necessarily consolidated into institutionalizing changes, but it was it suggested that there can be moments where you can build on and start actually putting those changes and those institutions in place. So I think 2020 is sort of symbolic of, in my mind, of understanding that those moments are available and that we need to build on them.
We are talking about Care-Centered Politics, From the Home to the Planet by Robert Gottlieb, and a fantastic collection of those things, Joy of Change projects. And I hear you saying, wow, if we could connect the dots with all of these, we could probably really experience that joy of change that you talk about. I want to thank you for all your great work, and I'm so excited about some of the ideas that you're putting forward here now, and it's so hopeful, and we need that so badly. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Heartland Stories Radio is brought to you by the Heartland Health Research Alliance, conducting science to enhance public health and environmental quality through food and farming innovation. You can find out more at heartlandhealthresearchalliance.org.
Whenever we're in Portland, we always try to put in at least 5 or 6 hours at Cable,
right?
Because we're
the Fire Sign Theater. So listen to 90.7 FM for Cable.
Hello, welcome to a very special edition of Film at 11. Joining me are, of course, Lisa Neville of University of New York, Cortland, and Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time, and